Rabbi Brodowitz, Wednesday, February the 5th, 1998,
Devorim. Rabbi Brodowitz.
Yeah, well, we began looking at the Decalogue last week, the Aseret HaDibrot. Again, just to point out that the translation, the common translation of the Ten Commandments, is not quite accurate, because if you look at what is commonly called the Second Commandment, you will see a number of thou shalt nots in there. For example, Pasuk Zion, verse 7, this is chapter 5, verse 7, says, thou or you shall not have any gods besides me, you shall not make idols, you shall not bow down to them, you shall not worship them. All of that is counted in the so-called Second Commandment. Now, in point of fact, if you count mitzvot based on the thou shalt not do, if you look at Maimonides' lists or the like, you actually find in this Second Commandment four prohibitions concerned with idolatry. And all of them are subsumed under the Second Commandment. So if the word commandment has any meaning at all, the most it could refer to is categories of prohibition. And within a single commandment, there might be many discrete prohibitions. And in fact, as you know, the translation of Aseret HaDibrot or Aseret HaDevarim means the ten communications, the ten statements, etc. So just to be precise here in terms of how Maimonides, for example, understands this, verse 7 says, you shall not have any other gods, al panai, that means in my face, literally. But of course, since God's face is the totality of the universe, that means if you can find a place where I'm not, you can have your idol, but not where I am. That's al panai. Maimonides says, this is the prohibition against belief in other Elohim besides God. Now the word Elohim is a very interesting word. Elohim in the Torah does not necessarily connote God. For example, the judicial process, judges, are referred to as Elohim. That's why I don't say Elohim. We say Elohim when we refer to God. We say Elohim if we refer to other powers. So the real translation of Elohim is powers. And in fact, it is a plural, it's in a plural form. So when the Torah says, you shall not have Elohim Acherim, that suggests there is such a thing as Elohim Acherim. There is such a thing as other powers in the world. Of course, we don't call them gods. Other powers in the world. But a Jew is not supposed to acknowledge those other powers as being superior.
Where are some of these other powers?
Well, the powers, there are angels that have powers. There are stars, there are planets, there are natural phenomena. Human beings have powers. Judges have powers. Judges are referred to as Elohim in many places. And you can look at it two ways. You can give it a theological twist, that judges are acting as emissaries of the divine, and therefore they're endowed with a quality of quasi-divinity. Or you can look at it from the opposite approach, that Elohim is not necessarily divinity at all. Elohim just refers to power. And therefore, that's why we can talk about God as Elokei, this phrase, Elokei ho Elohim, the God of gods. What do you mean, the God of gods? You know, it's Elokei ho Elohim. How can God be the God of gods? There are no other gods. The answer obviously is that that's really a mistranslation. It really means the power above all powers. Okay? And therefore, there is such a thing as other Elohims, but one should not make them divine. So, lo yielcha is the prohibition against belief in other gods. Now, I'm not sure if I mentioned this last week, because I speak in a lot of different places. I don't remember what I say in one place versus the other place. But basically, this concept of avodah zarah, which literally means foreign worship, was a great temptation at various times in our history. Look at the Book of Kings and etc., where it seems like everybody and his brother was going around worshiping idols. And in fact, the Talmud mentions a wonderful story where the rabbis were discussing that certain kings will not have a share in the world to come because they were so evil. And it mentions King Manasseh, who was a king. He was the son of a very righteous man, King Hezekiah, Hizkiyahu HaMelech. And in fact, Hizkiyahu HaMelech had a premonition that he would have a son that would be very evil, and therefore he didn't want to get married and have kids. And the prophet Yeshayahu, Isaiah, declared that Chizkiyahu should die because of his reluctance to have children. And when Chizkiyahu said, "Well, what should I do? I know my child will be an evildoer." And Yeshayahu told him, "It's none of your business to delve into the secrets of God. You do what you're supposed to do, and the consequences may be whatever the consequences are." And of course, Chizkiyahu's premonition was indeed fulfilled. And his son Manasseh, who became king at the young age of 12, and had a very long reign of over 50 years, was indeed a very, very evil king in many, many ways. Of course, from a psychological standpoint, I always wonder if Chizkiyahu's premonition became a self-fulfilling prophecy, meaning you give birth to a child, you are firmly convinced that this child it will become an evil person. So how do you raise the child? Now, one could speculate as to how that's going to work. But be it as it may, the rabbis of the Talmud were declaring, this guy, Manasseh, is such a bad guy, he certainly has no share in the world to come. So that night, Manasseh came to them in a dream. And Manasseh said to them, if you have any questions in the Torah that you don't understand, ask me them. And they asked him all their most difficult questions, and he was a phenomenal, learned Talmid Chacham. And he was able to answer all of their questions. He was a master of the Torah. So they asked him, I'm not sure how they communicated exactly, but they asked him, gee, you're such a learned person. How could you fall to the depths of degradation that you fell to? So he said, you don't know what it's like. If you would have been there in the days of the idol worship, you would have cut your legs running through the thorns to get to that nearest idol. You don't even understand what the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah was. And indeed, the Talmud relates a very interesting story that at the time of the Second Temple, the dedication of the Second Temple, in the hands of Ezra and Nehemiah, they were the builders of the Second Temple, Ezra asked God for an extraordinary thing. Ezra said, you know, this Yetzer Hara for idolatry is so overpowering that, God, could you just take it away from us? Because we really don't know how to fight it. And they fasted for 3 days of 3 nights, and the Yetzer Hara went away, and in fact, there's even a visualization of it. It was a lion of fire that left the Holy of Holies, which is a peculiar place for the evil of idolatry to reside. Now, I'll discuss what that would be. And it ran into the Judean deserts. And from that, I'm just quoting a Gemara here. And from that time onwards, we no longer have the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. We don't have that evil inclination anymore. And then the Gemara goes on that they wanted to take away the Yetzer Hara for sexual temptation. And they tried to do that, but then husbands weren't with wives, and chickens weren't with roosters, hens weren't with roosters. So they figured we have to bring that back into the world. That's needed. But the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah is not here anymore. And the Vilna Gaon explains, however, that it was replaced by the desire for materialism. Meaning to say, if we want to know what the passion for idolatry was like, we have to go back and ask ourselves what the passion for money and accumulation of wealth was like. And again, the concept was that Avodah Zarah is a spiritual passion. It's a passion for godliness. It's a passion to become close to God in an accessible, easily relatable form. So it comes from a good place, in a sense, but it can be perverted and dangerous, and therefore it was taken away and replaced by baser impulses, which are not as noble, but they're safer. That's always the balance, you know. When you have very high aspirations, you can be led astray in certain ways that those who are simpler folk may not necessarily have. Avodah Zarah was a very complex phenomenon. It was, as Maimonides writes, a desire to relate to God through the concept of intermediary. But it represented a passion for godliness that was misdirected. So, lo yiyah lecha is the proscription, the prohibition against Avodah Zarah. But then look at verse 8. Now this is still the second commandment. Lo taseh lecha taseh. You shall not make for yourself an idol or an image. Now, what is the difference between you shall not have and you shall not make? So Maimonides says this is the prohibition against the manufacture of idolatrous things. In other words, let's assume, remember Avraham's father, the famous story, which is not in the Chumash, but that Avraham's father made a living selling idols and objects of worship, and Avraham was once put in charge of the shop, and he smashed all the idols, and he put the axe in his in the idol's hands. And when his father said, "Why did you destroy the merchandise?" he said, "The idol did it." And even Terach said, "Well, I know idols can't do that." Well, Lo Tasalecha says that even if you're not an idolatrous believer, don't market this stuff to other people, because that is prohibited as well. Don't make them, don't sell them, and the like. Now then we have verse 9, which again, this is all in the second commandment, which says, "Do not bow down to them and do not worship them." This is counted as two distinct prohibitions. So, once again, certainly we subsume them generally under the category of don't engage in pagan worship and the like, but halakhically they are given technical definitions. And let me just quote you from the Talmud and the Mishnah, how they interpret these verses. Yeah.
Are there any traditions which would carry the prohibition against idol worship? The story that you just told is Talmudic.
Yes.
The worship of Israel.
Yes, very much so. In other words, granted that one cannot say that, you know, worshiping power, money, envy, or socialism or communism or any political ideal is halachic avodah zarah. It's not. It's not a capital crime. But certainly the concept of avodah zarah, of elevating anything beyond God as the focus of your life, is a form of idolatry. That is a theme that emerges in much midrashic literature and literature after that point. As well. Well, there is a concept, as I say, that avodah zarah has been given a metaphorical idea of anything which becomes the center of your life apart from the worship of God and the obedience to His commandments is a form of idolatry. We can engage in self-idolatry, very much so. And therefore, one who is involved in the creation of an excessive consumer culture, which feeds into those baser impulses, one could say figuratively that they are engaged in putting idols into the world. Yeah, I think that's so. That would not have the status of a halakhic ruling, you understand, but it would, I think, represent a certain value judgment to which people should try to aspire. I'm not going to tell somebody on an automobile assembly line, you know, who's making you know, $15 an hour, you have to quit your job and go on welfare. We wouldn't go that far.
That's just raising
a risk. That's not elevating the thought of family. Yes, but the point is this. The point is, if the Torah prohibits not only believing in the stuff, but making the stuff as well, so one could say perhaps one shouldn't even be a party in making the stuff, you know. But the truth of the matter is, as you know, Judaism is not an ascetic religion, or Judaism is not an anti-materialist religion per se. We do not elevate poverty to a sacred norm. And in fact, it's very, very interesting. There are two basic texts that actually talk about excessive asceticism as very sinful. One is the well-known declaration that the Nazarite, the one who takes a vow not to drink wine, is considered to be a sinner because he is abstaining from the legitimate pleasures that God put into the world. God said on all of His creation, Ki Tov, that it is good, and for a human being to say, you know, I don't engage in those permissible pleasures, is considered to be spitting in God's face, and on some level, it's a lack of gratitude to Hashem for the blessings in the world. There's even a more striking text in the Jerusalem Talmud, and don't tell your kids because they will use it against you, to the effect that a person will be called to account by God for every permissible pleasure in this world that they could have enjoyed, and they did not. God will say, why didn't you enjoy this? You know, why didn't you, you know, do A, B, and C? So on one level, there certainly is in the Jewish tradition a healthy understanding that the world should be enjoyed. It's a matter of pleasure, and it's a mechanism of expressing appreciation. However, we do have yet another strand in the tradition that teaches that the more that one is involved in material pursuits, the more blunted one's sensibilities are to the echoes of the divine. And therefore the answer is, yes, we should enjoy life, but not make it a focus, not make it a preoccupation, and not make it an obsession. Because the more one is involved in materialism, the less one is sensitive to God, and one should strive, indeed, to the extent it's possible, 20th century America, to have a simpler type of life and a life that is not so connected to possessions and things. That's the lesson of Sukkot, for example, in which at the time of harvest we leave the home and we go into a relatively simple hut to acknowledge that what is important is not the possessions, but what is important is our relationships to God and our relationships to each other, which is really what is meaningful in life. So, as is always the case, Judaism is really a balance between these ideas. And of course, the irony is that if one is less preoccupied with accumulation, one can indeed enjoy what one has even more. So you can actually, the simplification ties into the enjoyments of the material rather than an ascetic type of lifestyle. I'm sorry, yeah. Yes. The consumer gets consumed, right. Right. In fact, there's a beautiful thought from the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Chassidut, I mentioned in my other class, where he says that the halakha says that when you pray, you should pray in a room that has windows. This is halakha. This is why there's actually a law that a synagogue chapel should have windows. Now, actually, according to the Baal Shem Tov's interpretation, the stained glass window may not suffice. The Baal Shem Tov says that is because when one prays, one should be aware of what's going on outside of themselves. One should imagine the street and the teeming hordes of people who are poor or oppressed or sad or ill, and one should think about it, which is why the window should specifically be something which faces outward. And the Baal Shem Tov says, what's the difference between a window and a mirror? In a window, you see what is outside of you. In a mirror, you only see yourself. The difference is, a mirror is a piece of glass that has silver behind it. Again, that's a fancy mirror. The concept is that when you're involved in silver, kesef, when you're involved in money and materialism, you no longer see the other. You only see yourself. You become preoccupied with your needs. So he says that you don't daven in a room with a mirror, you daven in a room with a window. Try to take away that silver. Yeah. 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 That's right. Right. But he wants to be number one in charitable giving too, that even the charity becomes a contest. You know, I think Bill Gates is going to top that. You know, well, but still, you know, in other words, it's not that you're helping people to kind of give yourself another category in which you become number one. Yeah, well, you know, the Gemara says, a person has 100, they want 200. You know, Barbara Streisand used to say that, you know, how many pastrami sandwiches can you eat? You know, she said, you know, how much, you know, after the first billion, it really is just frosting on the cake, I would assume. But, yeah, I'm saying, but you know, there is a point in which one's life is not going to improve by any incremental increase in wealth, you know, and if anything, it's really the opposite. Marben nechasim, marben dagar. Now, the more income, the more you worry about it, etc. So, it's just an example of kind of the irrational forces that take us over, possess us, and of course, it's much more about power than it probably is about money, the ability to manipulate and control, which is a very powerful urge in a human being, and that is truly Avodah Zarah, where you put, you know, your power over everything else. In fact, just to give you another example of that, the Talmud says, and this is very worrisome, I think, for most of us, that he who loses their temper, he who has kas, he who has anger, is ki'ilu oved Avodah Zarah. It is as if they are denying God at that moment, because they are putting their needs and their hurts above all other considerations. And of course, in the moment of anger, a human being literally loses the capacity to think. Now, it may only be a second or 5 seconds, but there is that little fraction of time in which we totally surrender to that impulse. and that is a very, very evil thing. It's something, of course, that all of us do, and it's very difficult midah to uproot, but it is unequivocally an evil type of thing. Even though, once again, the balance, even though the Torah sometimes behaviorally dictates a response that's akin to anger, there might be a discipline issue or the like, but that is supposed to be a behavioral response. It is not supposed to be an effective response. By that I mean, there is the ideal person should never, as it were, lose control inside, even if behaviorally you're supposed to express anger. Right? There is a place to express anger in some ways, but it should never be with that sense of loss of control. In fact, I remember hearing from the Bus and the Rebbe. Some people don't like this story. They consider it psychologically unsound. But he made a point that his father used to hit him if he misbehaved. But his father would always wait 24 hours after the event, because the father did not want to hit a child out of anger. He wanted 24 hours to think about what the appropriate response was. And if he felt that some physical discipline was appropriate, it would be administered for the benefit of the child. Now, some psychologists don't like that approach because a child has no, you know, he gets hit 24 hours after he did something, he just has no sense. You know, what's he getting hit for? It seems to be arbitrary and capricious. But there is a real point, and that is all of us, I mean, again, I include myself, but all of us, well, maybe I shouldn't even speak for anybody here, but often, you know, in the guise of disciplining our children, we express our frustration, our anger, etc., and that may not be appropriate. We do have an obligation to provide discipline, guidance, and structure. That's very important. But the goal should be what is best for the child. And if that requires, just like kids have timeouts, parents need timeouts too. You know, go into the corner for 5 minutes and then come back and deal with it. Yeah.
Emotion is an involuntary internal kind of thing. How can the Torah say, don't get angry?
Well, that's the whole point, you know. There is a certain emotional reaction that is involuntary. It's physiologically, you know, generated adrenaline and everything else. But, you know, human beings do have the capacity to control that. There are exercises. There's biofeedback. In fact, there's some excellent books now written in the Jewish tradition about how to control anger and deal with anger. Rabbi Zelig Pliskin wrote a book. I think it's called Anger. And I think it's a very interesting subtitle called Anger, the Great Teacher. He says there's a lot of, if one becomes Zelig Pliskin, P-L-I-S-K, and he's written a lot of books on Jewish morality, but it's a very intriguing title because his thesis is that if we look at our anger dispassionately, kind of as if, let's kind of visualize that we're floating above ourselves, we can get tremendous insight into ourselves by analyzing what is it that sets us off. Why do certain interactions upset us? What are the words that trigger these visceral responses? And with that type of understanding, one can get a control over the issue. It's a very gradual process, indeed, but it's something that's very important.
It seems to me that it's not being angry that's forbidden by that concept. It's worshiping your anger. Everybody gets angry, but you have to understand that that moment of anger denies the reality of the universe around you, and so you don't dwell on it, and you don't ultimately, and I think we know people tend to worship their anger, that their indignation about the world is, or even their hot anger, is so important to them that they dwell in it.
Yeah.
That would be the thing that I think we
Yes, in other words, that's a good point. I mean, the Torah is not forbidding you to have that initial rush, that initial, whatever, constriction or however you describe it, but the Torah does say, you know, as you say, don't worship it and get beyond it and learn to transcend it. Keep it in the corner and don't let it dominate you. Don't let it be your king. And of course, the whole philosophy, by the way, of Chabad Chassidut, Lubavitch Chabad, is the concept that the duty of a human being, and it's funny because Chassidut we always associate with emotionalism, but it's very interesting that the whole theory of Chabad, at least in theory, is that one's mind and intellect can control the emotions and channel them in the proper way. In fact, the Bala Tanya even says that is why human beings walk upright. He says, and animals walk horizontally, because when you walk upright, the mind is above the emotion, as opposed to the head and the emotion being on the same level. Yep.
In order to have that choice of what to do, you have to understand that needs to be coached.
Yep.
In other words, it has to come from within. It has to come from the structure that's healthy within. Then it begins to do that.
In fact, there were Hasidic masters who used to talk about anger as something they had in their pockets. They had a pocket, an anger pocket, and a charity pocket, and they were able to just take on whatever attribute was needed to deal with a given situation, and then they could put it away. That type of control in which you do whatever needs to be done in a situation, and then you can put it away and get on to something else, a different type of response, as opposed to being locked into a certain modality which you're trapped in for hours or days or years. That's again a marvelous example of the self-control a human being is capable of.
My kids used to, and still do, try to push my button.
Yeah.
And speak mildly. I never thought of worshiping my anger, but I would really get very upset and, go kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Last semester in your modern philosophy course, Rabbi Halpern was doing Maimonides, and I had a report on the God they rock.
Right.
And I introduced my section by talking about my temper and then this idea that as if you are denying God. Right. And ever since then, I have been able to go from that visceral response, which was always leading to an immediate explosive reaction, stopping and thinking, and it has been absolutely
perfect. Yeah, well, so you're an actual case history that one can improve in this area. Well, that's really wonderful. It's Nachmanides writes, there's a famous letter that Ramban wrote to his son. In fact, this is a letter that studied kind of ethical guidance, talks about humility and the like. And Nachmanides gives his son the following suggestion. He says, whenever you study something in the Torah, you should try to immediately see how you can apply it in your personal life, and then it somehow becomes part of your personality. Now, of course, learning about anger—that's kind of an obvious example that can apply in our lives. It's a little more difficult when you're learning more abstract Talmudic passages about the ox that gores the cow. But even then, Nachmanides said you should try to find some practical lesson of how to apply it. Always ask yourself, how can I take this in my daily life? This notion of anger being avodah zara is really fundamental, and the Talmud goes on and talks about if you break something, that's even worse. There are different levels of idolatry, etc. So avodah zara is much more than just paganism per se, although obviously paganism is its core. By the way, there's all the halachic discussion, which we will not go into in great length at this point, regarding the status of modern day religions as being technical idolatry. Islam is very clearly not regarded as an idolatrous religion, because Islam is monotheistic. In spite of our disagreements with various factions of Islamic fundamentalism, but Islam as a religion is a monotheistic religion that does not involve the use of idols. Christianity, however, we have a long-standing debate. Of course, Christianity is hardly a monolith. You have Catholicism, Protestantism, hundreds of denominations, Eastern religious rites, and the like. In a passage of Maimonides, now Maimonides, of course, only lived in Islamic countries. Maimonides was never in a Christian country. But Maimonides writes in the Laws of Kings, and this is a censored passage. You will not find this in our printed editions of Maimonides. But Maimonides clearly writes that those who worship the Nozri, that's Jesus, are idolaters, are halakhic idolaters, and those who worship, those who are followers of Muhammad are not. So Maimonides took the position that Christianity, and of course in his day and age, that was before the Reformation, so there was no Protestant denomination, and Maimonides was probably only, I was going to say he was only familiar, even secondhand, with Roman Catholicism, but that's not necessarily true. He may have been aware of the Coptic churches and the Eastern rites. But Maimonides did consider that to be idolatrous because he considered the worship of Jesus and the Trinity in particular as putting God in human form, although technically it's the Son of God, but as it were, and therefore he treated that as Avodah Zarah. There is, however, another, and this was of course censored in the Middle Ages, so you're not going to find this in the standard printed versions.
There are
scientific editions of the Mishneh Torah that do have it, but in the standard edition it's been taken out. On the other hand, we do have the famous decision of Rabbeinu Tam. He was Rashi's grandson. He was of the school of the Tosafot school, who wrote the great glosses on the Talmud. Rabbeinu Tam lived in 13th century France, obviously a very heavily Catholic country, and Rabbeinu Tam makes the very interesting, almost double-think argument, where he says Christianity is not idolatry for a Christian, for a non-Jew, but it would be idolatry for a Jew. Meaning he posits, because remember, idolatry is one of the Noahide prohibitions. So he claims that for a Jew to affirm Christianity would be Avodah Zarah, based on the obligation of a Jew to believe in one God, but it is not a violation of the Noahide code. Meaning to say, it's okay for a non-Jew to be a Christian. It is not okay for a Jew to be a Christian, as you would expect. But you see, he premises it on the fact that he says Christianity, which again is probably, Rabbeinu Tam was probably only familiar with Catholicism. That was the only form of Christianity practiced in France, Roman Catholicism. Is he claimed that is called shituf, that is kind of duality, that's the Trinity, combining God with some other things, and he claimed that as long as one believes in, that God is in charge, as it were, he claimed that was not Avodah Zarah. So this is an old machloket, how a Jew relates to the Christian world. Again, if one is a historical sociologist, one would be tempted to say that Maimonides, validated Islam because that was the culture he was in. Rabbeinu Tam validated Catholicism because that was the culture he was in. But still, they do make these particular arguments. When it comes to Eastern religions, the halachic categorization of them is very, very complicated. Many say simply that things like Buddhism and the like are clearly idolatrous because of the korbanot, the offerings, the incense that is brought to statues. However, the Buddhists themselves strenuously claim that they are not, that it is not a paganistic religion. One is not worshipping the statue, etc. These are simply symbols. So it's not really clear how to characterize them. Many rabbis would say very, very explicitly that Hinduism, Buddhism, and a number of other Oriental and Indian religions do fall under the halakhic definition of Avodah Zarah. However, as I indicated, I think, last week, that does not mean that these religious traditions don't have very significant insights that can, in fact, be legitimately incorporated within a Jewish framework, such as meditation, spiritual exercises, and the like. In other words, the fact that a religion as a whole is Avodah Zarah, and we are enjoined from practicing it, does not automatically mean that there cannot be some good that can be taken from them. Did you have a question? Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess the question would become, though, the halakhic question would become, is the issue the physical act or is the issue of acknowledgement of supreme authority? Meaning to say, if one prostrates before an image, but the image is just a symbol of, the ultimate God that you believe in, would that be Avodah Zarah or not? In other words, is the emphasis on the external behavior or is the emphasis on the affirmation of belief? And of course, keep in mind that, contrary to popular opinion, Jews do not make the claim that the Ten Commandments are binding on Gentiles. The Gentiles, non-Jews, are bound by the seven Noahide laws, which, although they track to some degree the Ten Commandments, but they are not identical to the Ten Commandments. So the fact that something is forbidden for a Jew, this is Rabbeinu Tam's point, does not automatically turn it into a prohibition for non-Jews. Now, Rabbeinu Tam actually sets a very nice precedent for the notion of at least inter-religious pluralism, if not interdenominational, which is another issue going on in Israel right now. And that is, Rabbeinu Tam says, I can look at Christians and I can say that they have the right to worship God in that way. I do not regard them as pagans. I do not regard them as idolaters. I do not regard them as evil. Of course, they might be evil because of what they do to Jews. That's a separate matter. But their religious structure, per se, can be legitimated within a Jewish worldview. Rabbeinu Tam actually gives us a key by differentiating between what is idolatry under the Noahide Code and what is idolatry under Jewish law. So when it comes to Jews for Jesus, I can clearly oppose that as subverting and perverting what Judaism is, but that does not delegitimate Christians on their own terms. So it's kind of a useful way of allowing us, as it were, to coexist in the world with a sense of mutual respect and dialogue. Of course, the interdenominational wars, as you would expect, are always going to be more difficult to resolve than the first one, but at least in that sense, I can, you know, respect the Pope as a great person, a spiritual leader, in spite of the fact that for me to become a Christian would be an act of idolatry and renunciation. So Rabbeinu Tam kind of gives us the key to view the Christian world in that way. And of course, Islamic world could certainly view that way, because Islam, under any definition, is not classified as an idolatrous religion. Yeah. Absolutely, that's correct. Well, yes, there is. Well, first of all, the issue about proselytism in Judaism is a little bit complicated. It's fairly clear that the traditional halakhic approach has been that our initial response is to discourage conversions and certainly not to actively proselytize. Now, as you know, the Reform movement has recently taken a different position, and some historians argue that even historically, centuries ago, Jews were very active proselytizers, and that simply stopped as a result of the Roman persecutions, the same thing that threw the Christians to the lion, you know, threw the Jews to the lions as well. And the rabbinic attitude was an outgrowth of the Roman persecutions. Now again, halakhically, I don't accept that. Halakhically, I think our traditional approach has been we discourage proselytization. Christianity does believe much more in preaching the gospel. And again, all I can say is that we have to be strong enough in our own faith to try not to respond to that message. Well, no, not really, because it's the opposite. You know, Jesus' second coming will come whether you're ready or not. The only thing is, you'll burn in hell if you know you're not fortunate enough to accept. They do not say that the second coming cannot come until. The second coming will come at a predetermined time. If anything, we, in our tradition, may say that the coming of the Mashiach awaits not people becoming Jewish, but people, you know, acknowledging God. And it's fascinating that in the very passage that Maimonides writes, the censored passage where Maimonides writes, Christians are idolaters, he says the following interesting point, that Christianity and Islam were way stations to wean people away from paganism and idolatry, to eventually bring them to the worship of one God. Which means, in the same sentence in which he disparages Christianity, he also recognizes it as a very useful way of weaning people away. And of course, I think Maimonides may have a point that even he may not have been aware of, and that is indeed, a lot of Christianity incorporated pagan ritual, and that is how, even today in Cuba, take the form of Catholicism that's practiced in Cuba, is very much bound together with really paganistic rites. Things like the Christmas tree, all of these have certain pagan rites, which were then assimilated into a religious tradition, and it was a way of bringing people over to that worship. And Maimonides acknowledges the transitional role of even semi-idolatrous religions as bringing people to the worship of God. So he does assign a positive role in history to religion. Now, we know, of course, that religion has also been tremendously destructive, but he still regards it as bringing people forward in that closeness to God. Okay, but I just wanted to give you a technical definition here. In other words, we actually have four prohibition. It's fascinating. In the so-called second commandment, there are four thou shalt nots. Thou shalt not have other gods, which is the prohibition against belief in idolatry. There is thou shalt not make idols. That's a prohibition against manufacture, distribution, and sale. In other words, don't make business by catering to people's idolatrous beliefs. Actually, I get questions sometimes from Jews who are in the jewelry business. Am I allowed to sell crucifixes or things like that? Because after all, the commandment says, you shall not make, which is also interpreted as not making and selling. It may depend. I think the answer largely is yes, because this only prohibits making objects which are actually going to be worshipped. So you couldn't, as it were, sell the crucifix that'll be over the altar. Or you couldn't be, make the Pope's crucifix or the Cardinal's crucifix or whatever it is. But the kind of jewelry that people wear, just like a Jew wears a Magen David, to kind of identify what they believe in. So one may wear a crucifix to identify what they believe in, but the crucifix itself is not part of the worship service in many cases. So again, one can argue that, but I think there may be a basis for that distinction. Third prohibition, thou shalt not bow down to them. And the fourth prohibition is thou shalt not worship them. In halakha, these are given very, very precise parameters. And that is, in order, Avodah Zarah, as you know, is a capital crime in the eyes of the Torah. One can get the death penalty for idolatry. Now, that doesn't mean it's extensions. For example, if you lose your temper, you're not going to get the death penalty. In other words, the extensions of Avodah Zarah do not carry that sanction. But the core of Avodah Zarah is a capital offense, and the punishment will be stoning. Now, as you know, there are many procedural technicalities for capital punishment that make it almost impossible. The witnesses have to warn you, and you have to acknowledge the warning, etc. But assuming all of those conditions are met, there is a death penalty. Now, the death penalty, though, is very narrow in this sense. In order to be sentenced to death for Avodah Zarah, the modality of worship is very crucial. You either worship it in the manner in which this idol is normally worshipped, I'll give you an example, or you incorporate the forms of worship that exist in the Beit HaMikdash towards the idol. The example is the following. The Gemara gives an example that there was a certain idol that was worshipped by defecation. That's Baal Peor. So if one defecates in front of that idol, that would be Avodah Zarah because that's the way it's worshipped. If one would defecate in front of another idol, even thinking that that's the way you worship it, you would not be sentenced to death, because that is not the way it is worshipped. So, one basis for the capital offense is to worship the idol the way it is worshipped. And the second basis is, if you take any of the temple ceremonies, such as slaughtering a korban, a sacrifice, libation of wine, burning of incense, or bowing down, you are chayav mitah, you are sentenced to death, even if that is not the way that it's worshipped. So there are two separate alternative tracks, as it were, how you can be sentenced to death. One is doing the temple things, which are God's worship, taking God's worship and doing it for the idol, and that would include korban, slaughtering of an offering, that would include wine libation, that includes incense, that includes bowing. And the second way you could be chayav mitah is by worshipping it the way it is normally worshipped, even if that involves defecation or the like. And these are encapsulated in these two prohibitions. Lo tishtachaveh, do not bow down, is the shorthand for do not appropriate the modalities by which God is worshipped for the idol. And lo ta'avdeh means do not serve the idol the way the idol is customarily served. So this breakdown is to indicate in Talmudic tradition certain technicalities in the chiyuv mitah, the death sentence for Avodah Zarah. Meaning to say, it's very interesting, that simply acknowledging an idol, if I just say, I believe in this idol, that is not a capital, that's Avodah Zarah, but that's not something. The capital offense requires overt acts of worship and homage in one form or another.
Since we no longer have sacrifices no longer occur in the Beit HaMikdash, and certain prayers are substituted, is the use of those prayers that technically be
That's a very excellent question, and you have a strong point, but I don't believe the halakha has been redefined in that way. Meaning to say, halakha would still say that the capital, of course we don't administer capital punishment, but the theoretical capital crime of Avodah Zarah would still require things like sacrifice and the like, and not merely the recitation of prayers. Now, that doesn't mean to say you're allowed to recite these prayers. I'm just referring to the death sentence.
Punishment phase, not when you're guilty or
absolutely, yes. That's correct. In other words, it's limited to punishment matters, which in this day and age is of less practical importance because we do not administer the punishment for idolatry in any circumstance. Yeah.
In the tractate Zvachim, there are very, very detailed ways of conducting the animal sacrifice.
Yes.
Cutting of the trachea, etc.
Yes.
Is that what we mean by Avodah Zarah animal sacrifice? Or just killing the animal and saying, I'm killing this animal
for the purpose of... Yeah, you're correct. You're raising a good point that nobody is going to say that in order to be guilty of Avodah Zarah or to the penalty phase, you have to do a kosher shechita. In other words, it doesn't have to correspond with every detail of Jewish law. Killing the animal would be enough. Now, it's interesting that I read years ago in Psychology Today about the resurgence of animal sacrifice cults. You know, it's an issue. So they described, you know, a lot of them come from the Caribbean and the like, and some from Africa. So they described a fellow in Chicago, this was an amazing thing, who was a Jewish accountant, mild-mannered Jewish accountant during the week. He was in his 50s at the time, and on the weekends he donned the garments of the high priest of one of these groups, and he would slaughter goats for idolatry. Now, what was fascinating about it is that you really get an insight in what the power of animal sacrifice is. Now, it's something that we read Leviticus and the like, and many of us are repelled. And we say, you know, are we asking God to bring this back, bring back the korbanot and the like? And of course, as you know, Maimonides, as a general rule, disparaged the ultimate spiritual idea of the korbanot. In the famous passage in the Guide to the Perplexed, Maimonides argues, once again, that korbanot were a way station. That in pagan rites, they used to slaughter humans and animals. And God wanted, and since this was something that was very attractive to people, the ceremony, the pageant, the spilling of the blood, so God wanted to give them a way to legitimate it and contain it within a Jewish religious structure. So it was a concession to the baser impulses to wean people away from idolatry, but Maimonides argues prayer is ultimately much more superior to korbanot. Now that's Maimonides' view, and that's a famous passage of Maimonides, but I have to say that Maimonides' view seems to be contradicted by the Jewish liturgy itself. I mean, according to Maimonides, why do we pray, at least in the traditional ritual, not just for the Beit HaMikdash, which you could argue serves other functions besides korbanot, meeting place, etc., but we specifically pray in the Musaf for the restoration of the sacrificial rite. And Nachmanides, the great mystic who often argues with Maimonides, takes very strong issue with Maimonides, and Nachmanides offers an alternative explanation of korbanot, which is somewhat Kabbalistic and symbolic, in which he says that korbanot reenacts a symbolic death of the sinner. You commit a sin and you recognize your life should be forfeited, and by God's mercy he allows you vicariously to experience that through the death of the animal. And Nachmanides argues, again, sounds a little bit Christian, but that's okay, they got it from us. In other words, you have to keep in mind that every central idea in Christianity is ultimately derived from something in Judaism, and then it gets twisted and turned and changed and amplified. But the fact that something sounds Christian means it does resonate in the Jewish tradition. But the difference is this. Nachmanides makes the point, this is where the bridge is very critical, that the notion of symbolic death and vicarious atonement is not that one person's death can atone for me, but it reawakens me to my moral imperative to repent and change my life. That's a crucial notion, that the symbol is supposed to effect a self-transformation and a recognition of the person's personal responsibility for their life. Now, when I read this article in Psychology Today, this is Avodah Zarah. Here you have a person who's slaughtering goats through idols. And yet, he described what this karban meant in exactly the same terms as Nachmanides. And he wasn't quoting anybody, but he just said, you know, you feel the life force and you recognize how precious life is and you recognize your responsibilities. So I think you got a sense of how powerful the Korban was for the ancient societies in ways that is difficult for most of us to envision today. I mean, just too bad, you know, he's born in the wrong time, wrong place, you know. Maybe if you, I don't know if he's a Kohen, but if, you know, 2,000 years ago, he could have done this in the Beit HaMikdash. Yeah. Right.
Way of channeling.
Right.
Things that are given to you.
Yes, that's true. Because the problem is, though, when you don't have a Beit HaMikdash, and he has, in other words, it's difficult to find the channeling for that. Well, okay, you're right. I guess Shrita, on some level, although it doesn't have the same oomph as a Korban to God. But you're right. That's the very famous passage in the Gemara, where if a person is born under the constellation of Mars, the red planet, he will be a shedder of blood, but he can choose to be a shochet or a moha, circumciser of children, or a murderer. That's his choice. And that's very relevant, by the way, when you talk about the Human Genome Project. Now, our chacham, you know, we talk about mapping and sequencing genetic genes of the human body. And we're going to find a gene for everything, eventually. We're going to find a depression gene, no doubt. We're going to find anger gene, violence gene, fat gene, right? Everything's going to be genetically based. And people often raise the question as to what implications does that have towards human responsibility and accountability if we behave the way we behave because of a genetic disposition that we have. The answer is very simple, basically. The answer is there are predispositions, and then there's the ability of a human being to channel those predispositions. Now, the rabbis of the Talmud did not talk about genetics because that was not the science that was known. They talked about mazel. And we could, you know, poo-poo that and say, oh, that's astrology. But that's ignoring a larger point. The concept of mazel was a recognition that there is a predetermined aspect of human personality that is non-volitional. We would call it DNA, and they would call it the planet you're born under. But the insight of the passage is not so much, you know, the planet you're born under, but the insight is predispositions do not determine destiny, and there is an ability to make choices within the parameters of the personality that we're given.
The whole notion of free will versus determinism, that's a constantly shifting tie one way or the other. But one thing that's interesting about it is that when you're looking at ascribing responsibility to people, blame or praise, let's say, for their actions, it seems that on the one hand, when you increase your knowledge, the more we know, the less we can ascribe praise or blame. After all, if genes, talent, ability, yeah, got into that sort of thing, or if impersonal social forces, as in Marxism, are the reason why class, mm-hmm, whichever, right, the more we think we know, the less we can ascribe responsibility. But by the same token, the less we think we know, when we say we can't put ourselves in the position of Genghis Khan, because who knows what the possible reasons were for him to behave the way they were, but we can't describe blame or praise.
Yeah.
So in both cases, there seems to be a direction of away from ascribing such things.
Yeah.
But we know with ourselves, or we think we know a great deal about our motives, the more we know does not take away our sense of responsibility for what we've done.
That's right.
We very seldom say, well, I know now why I did it, so I guess I wasn't at fault.
Right.
We do have a sense that we have choices.
Right.
And that,
yeah,
like,
well, yeah,
between those two immense icebergs of lack of responsibility of being able to evade it, but nonetheless, we have a sense that that does exist.
It does, yeah, and part of the problem in late 20th century America is that that sensibility is being eroded to some degree, in which everybody passes the buck onto something else. My parents, my environment, my friends, my school, there's always someone else to blame, mm-hmm, as opposed to, you know, we would actually say, Bechira.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is what God gave me. But the question is, nobody, no matter how devout, is going to take the position that, you know, this is what God gave me and I can't change. Let's assume, for example, there's a breast cancer gene that can be corrected. I think every person in the world would say, if you can correct those diseases, go ahead and do it. In fact, the Torah enjoins us to cure illness and heal, and that is not considered an interference with the divine plan. The question gets more complicated, I think, when you move beyond the obviously physical ailments and you deal with emotional characteristics. I would think that if, for example, there's some genetic predisposition to severe depression, that would fall into the category of illness that should be alleviated. On the other hand, when you start talking about manipulating for eye color or sex or improving athletic abilities or the like, or even intelligence, you run into certain problems with playing God. That's right. That's the problem. I mean, see, that's exactly part of the problem of playing God. You know, I often say that to say that we shouldn't play God is an oversimplification, because to some degree God commands us to play God. But the fact that a human being is in the image of God means we are supposed to create in the world, do things in the world, alleviate human misery. So to say we shouldn't do something because it's God's province is an oversimplistic response to things we're supposed to do. However, when you're talking about those types of trade-offs, that's kind of a form of primitive, a form of advanced lobotomy, where you're simply saying, you know, you have too many seizures, let's cut out the brain, and if that makes you whatever it makes you, you know, that's going to be fine. That type of weighing is a very, very difficult balance, and perhaps we should assume that God has a purpose in linking these things, and we should leave them as were, and explore alternative ways of dealing with the problem. That's really difficult. And of course, part of the problem with the genetic thing is that we can identify illnesses and predispositions that may not manifest themselves for many, many years. Talk about Huntington's. A person might have 30, 40 years of healthy living because of the long latency period, and yet people are making abortion decisions based on these time bombs. And besides the fact, how do you balance the value of 30, 40 years of life? Where's medical science going to be in 30 and 40 years? There might be a cure in 10 years. So to make these types of decisions is very, very difficult. Yeah. Yep. But I will tell you that under the Netherlands experience, it has been discovered, I'm not sure what the time period was, but over a certain time period, over 50% of the assisted suicides were because of treatable depression. Under Dutch law, that is not even allowed. And yet, you know, patient wants it, doctor wants it, so who's going to complain, right? I mean, you know, nobody's around to make an issue over it. But that is a real warning bell when you talk about the possible legalization of assisted suicides in the United States. You know, the Supreme Court declared a few months ago, that there is no constitutional right to assisted suicide, but that means every state is free to allow it or not allow it. And there's a tremendous movement in a number of states to legitimate assisted suicides. And one of the major, major concerns, ethically, besides the, you know, halakhic concerns, of which there are many, but is that many people who can be treated for depression or for pain management will opt to take their lives because those alternatives are not being pursued. Pain management in particular is a real problem in American medicine. there's a long tradition of kind of ignoring pain. For example, doctors would not give morphine to patients in the last few months of life because they don't want them to become addicted. But, you know, like, who cares? And the surveys show that those who are in favor of physician-assisted suicide is because a person's greatest fear is having uncontrollable pain at the end of their life. And therefore they want that option. But if we would put the resources into pain management, the push for assisted suicide would really be greatly diminished. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I understand. I understand. Yes, I understand that, and you know, halakha recognizes that we cannot condemn. See, halakha has a catch 22. Halakha says anyone who commits suicide has no share in the world to come. We don't sit shiva for them, etc. It's a big sin, and yet the halakha says that's only true if it's premeditated and done not out of despair and despondency. If one does it out of despair or despondency, they are considered to be temporarily insane, and we do sit shiva for them. And then the halakha goes on and says, since nobody would kill themselves unless they were in that state, so as a practical matter, there's almost an irrebuttable presumption that the person acted in that state. So we do have the stance where you can't condemn the actor, but you condemn the act. We cannot sit in judgment on what people do in extreme situations, but we cannot normatively hold that up as a proper thing to do. Okay, let me just get back to the verses here. So the second commandment is the prohibition against idolatry, and as we see, it does comprise four distinct commandments, four interrelated but distinct commandments. Then there is the famous passage that says, I am a jealous God who will visit the sin of the fathers unto the children, unto the third generation and unto the fourth generation, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Now, here, we do have a very famous question that the Talmud already raises, where this seems to suggest collective guilt, meaning to say God punishes the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren for the sins of the fathers. And yet, we have a verse in Deuteronomy that says, Lo yumtu avot al banim, fathers shall not be punished for the sins of the children. Children shall not be punished for the sins of the parents. Each person is accountable for what they do. This is also in Ezekiel, Yechezkel. So how do you reconcile the notion of each person is responsible for their own actions with the notion of God will punish the children for the sins of the fathers? So the Talmud says, an interesting point, the Talmud says, it all depends on whether the children or the descendants endorse and validate the evil that the predecessor generations did. If they endorse it and they validate it, then indeed God treats them as if they are vicarious perpetrators. The example would be, if a neo-Nazi group gets up and says, you know, well, we're very happy that the Jews were gassed in Auschwitz and we wish they would have finished the job, then God says, although you may not have committed the act, but by linking yourself up to that past, you are endorsing it, you are validating it, and you become part of it. When, however, a child or a descendant disassociates himself or herself from the evil of the past generation, then God does not hold them accountable. This is a distinction the Talmud makes. Now, it's an interesting implication if you think about, you know, I've even participated in some of these discussions about what should our relationship be with Germany. Right, it's an issue, or Poland or Eastern Europe generally, where many people feel that there's no way that we could have any type of rapprochement with the German people because of what they did to the Jews in the Holocaust, etc. Of first. You could apply the same logic with Poland and a number of other countries as well. In fact, more Jews died in Poland than in Germany, and the Poles ran the concentration camps. But nevertheless, this is an issue. Others say, well, it's a new generation. These people weren't involved, etc. And don't we believe in tshuva? And maybe tshuva is not even an issue here, because tshuva would refer to those who perpetrated doing tshuva. That's a separate issue. That's not up with the sunflower. But here you're talking about a generation that was born after the Holocaust, etc. And without necessarily answering the particular question, because it would depend on the person, there is a hint here that a child, a descendant, should not be tainted with the sin of the fathers if there is true disassociation and repudiation and rejection of the evil that that earlier generation perpetrated. Now, whether that's the case is a matter of debate, and it would depend. I mean, sometimes the desire for overtures is just a matter of expediency and everything else, and that's a different story. Sometimes there is a sincere repudiation, and this seems to indicate that we would not, as it were, people are not genetically tainted with a predisposition toward evil because of what their parents or grandparents did.
What's the location of the contradictory
statement? Yes, it is in... Oh, let me find it. One is in Ezekiel, but there's actually a verse in the Torah itself. It should be in Parshat Shoftim. Let me just find it. I believe it should be chapter 19. I'll give you the... Yeah, I'm having difficulty finding it. I can find it later, but see, the verse
in
verse in Deuteronomy is not as conclusive as the verse in Ezekiel, because the verse in Deuteronomy can be interpreted in a technical sense of the laws of testimony, where fathers do not testify against children, children do not testify against fathers, and is not necessarily making the broader theological point. In the book of Ezekiel, however, it's very clear that he is not addressing the evidentiary rules in a court. He is addressing the theological point.
This might not be what was intended, but the fact is, the father are very often considered on the children, because in deciding to say this, it's not forget.
Well, I think that's a possibility, and that goes back to the notion of consequence rather than punishment. And indeed, that's an important idea. To say, you know, it's very nice to say that in a moral sense, children should not be held accountable for what parents do, right? And indeed, that's what Ezekiel says, and that makes sense to us. On the other hand, there is no doubt that children bear very heavy consequences. Let's take, for example, even take a physical manifestation like AIDS, right? Babies are born with AIDS because of behaviors that their parents engaged in. So you might say, well, what's going on here? Is it right that a child should be punished? The answer is, we're not talking about the realm of punishment here. We're talking about behaviors have consequences. If mother ingests cocaine, the baby will be born a cocaine baby. If there's intravenous drug use causing AIDS, the baby will have the AIDS virus. So indeed, it could very well be, your point is well taken, that God is not so much announcing a doctrine of retribution, but God is announcing a doctrine of warning. Won't beware. That's right. That's right. Yes. Beware, parents. What we do in our life does not only affect us, but it affects the future generations. So I think it's a good way of looking at it, but you're not looking at, you know, God punishing, but God is just saying that the evil that is done generates consequences that are destructive for future generations as well. And therefore, you know, a person's attitude might be, I don't care about my life, I'll do what I want, because it only affects me. But the answer is that, particularly if you're going to be a parent, it does not just affect you. Yeah.
You mentioned endorsing and repudiation. What about silence? Is there a requirement to repudiate if...
That's an excellent question. That's an undistributed middle. The Talmud does not clearly address that there, but I think from other statements, it's very, very clear that silence in the face of evil is treated as a form of endorsement. So we're dealing with protest and repudiation.
So far, but then going back to the German situation, is that not only that they've gone beyond, because with all the three options, and then yeah. provide by the people that didn't, they are taking
I mean, the Holocaust was obviously, an absolutely horrendous, staggering evil that existed in this world, one of the greatest evils that ever happened. However, you know, I'm not sure, I agonize over this. Do we have the right, as it were, to condemn the silence? You know, people who would have spoken up would have endangered their own lives. And do we have the right to say, you should have endangered your life? Now again, the righteous Gentile who did that was behaving in a saintly way, a good, right? So, do we look at those who were not saints as evil people? Oh, okay, that's okay. You're right. At that point, at a point when it's safe and you don't denounce it, yeah, I think you're right. But I think the issue of the complicity, again, we have Goldenhagen's book, you know, about the complicity of the ordinary German, the controversial thesis. Yeah. But the issue about do we have the right to condemn somebody who didn't protest when that would have endangered their life? It's a complicated issue. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if we have the right to say that. Those who did are righteous and deserving of the greatest admiration. I'm not sure if we could turn it around. Yeah. Well, I would think so. I would think that's a minimum, really. Of course, as you know, the state of Israel has had no hesitation in accepting reparations and all sorts of stuff from Germany.
In the relationship with Germany, it's fine.
Yeah.
They have a big thing now in the ditch and stuff. You know, the mineral for getting to Europe.
Yeah.
It's going to
the other side. Well, that's right. And every time you go into a bus or in a taxi, or you're going in a Mercedes-Benz vehicle. On the other hand, we have a lot of people, particularly Holocaust survivors, who will not buy anything German, will not step into Germany, will not travel to Eastern Europe. They will
and
not do this very day.
I think that's always an interesting dichotomy because just as there are some things in Israel that are not an issue in Israel for Israeli Jews, it's different in the diaspora. We in the diaspora are seem to be more, prone to this kind of thing of holding on to whatever reason.
Well,
you get reparations, you get money.
Yeah, but there are people who are against the concept of reparations because reparations can give the donor a sense that they've made up, they've redressed the balance, and perhaps there should be something that's not compensated for, not compensable. Right.
I did not know that existed.
Well, I was involved in this at at a convention. They actually had a mayor from a German city who kind of addressed the Jewish group, saying, we want to have connections and we repudiate the past. And there was a whole discussion about repentance and repudiating what the forefathers stood for. And the reactions in the audience were very, very intense on both sides of the question. People were really screaming at each other because it's a very, very painful, painful issue to this very day. Again, I'm not resolving it at all. I'm just suggesting that the Gemara already points out in this dichotomy of holding the children accountable for the sins of the parents versus not is based on the endorsement and connection to that past is a key to whether they should be held morally accountable. That hate me. Yeah. That's a good point. So that hate me would refer to the children, not just the parents. Yeah, that's a good point. That would lend some support to that. Then it says, though, that God also remembers the good that people do. And it's interesting, it says, and God does chesed, loving kindness. La'alafim, alafim is thousands. The minimum is 2,000. To the 2,000th generation, to those who love God and keep His commandments. The Talmud says, we see from this, that if you quantify it, I'm not sure how you quantify it, that God is 500 times more merciful than He is punitive. Because the punitive sanction at a maximum goes only for 4 generations, and the goodness goes up to 2,000 generations. So 2,000 divided by 4 is 500. So that is the so-called second commandment, which by and large is concerned with idolatry, paganism, and the like, although we do have that very interesting reference to collective guilt and passing the guilt of the parents onto the children. Commandment number 3 is very short. Yeah. Yes, the word jealous is interesting. Kinah we translate as jealousy. And you wonder, gee, God is a jealous God? I thought jealousy is not good. Jealousy is supposed to be an attribute that we're supposed to eradicate. It says, Kinah tavah v'kavod. Jealousy, lust, and honor, glory, are things that destroy a person. So all of a sudden we're describing God as jealous. And jealous seems like a low emotion. The true translation of kana is not jealous, but it's zealous. Pinchas is called the kanoet kinati. He was zealous on my behalf. And zealous refers to the notion that God is very speedy to exact retribution for avodah zarah, but not because of the emotion of jealousy, but rather because God wants this evil to be eradicated from the world. And kinah refers to the certainty of retribution and punishment. Again, not automatic, not speedily necessarily. I shouldn't say speedily, but certainty. That unless there's tshuva, this type of evil will carry with it a consequence. So I think it's a mistranslation, actually, to translate kinah as jealous in this sense.
JPS.
What do they say?
JPS.
Yes.
Impassioned.
Ah, that's a very nice translation. That's good. But even impassioned does not refer to God losing His cool, so to speak. But it refers to the speedy and expeditious retribution that idolatry brings to the world. You know, in this context, this pasuk is talking about idolatry, but the Talmud divorces it from that. The Talmud takes this as a general statement, and it's written in the verse of idolatry simply because idolatry is the most general rebellion against God that one could conceive, but this applies with equal force in many rebellions against God as well, not keeping Shabbat, Kashrut, Lashon Hara, all of these different things.
You know, I know people.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell you about 2,000, and I
1,000. Do you have 1,000? It says, no, well, alafim is a plural form. Elef is 1,000. Alafim are thousands. And a plural without a number is always a minimum of 2. Do you actually have the word, do you have one?
I'm looking for...
No, it should say thousands.
It says to the thousandth generation.
Oh, well, that's not quite accurate. Because alafim, elef is 1,000, and alafim is thousands. Yeah.
You know, I was thinking also of the meaning of kanah, being twin. When someone adheres to someone, you've got a principle.
Yes, I think that's excellent. That's really what zealousness is. Zealous is fidelity to principle. Yeah, I think that's right. It does not connote jealousy, but the fact that God will stick by His guns, so to speak, in this. Okay, and will not compromise. Well, zealous is to behave with zeal, with passion, with immediacy, with strictness. without compromise or dilution of commitment. Again, I think your point is very well taken, that that's what we are referring to. The third commandment, do not take the name of God, Lashov, in vain, because God will not exonerate those who take God's name in vain. We know that this is the source for many, many halachot. This is the source for why people write G-D. There's a whole question whether you have to do that, but the concept is technically you probably do not have to do that. But it's an expression of reverence for the name of God. That is why in Hebrew we don't pronounce commonly. That's why we say Elohim instead of with the hey. That's why we say Hashem, the name, instead of saying, you know, Aleph Dalet and Nun Yud. There's a concept that the name of God should not be said unless it's in the context of the study of Torah or the reciting of a bracha or prayer or the like. That is why we have laws of Shemot, that papers in which the name of God is written should be put away in a special place. They should not be thrown into the garbage. This creates horrendous problems with newspapers that occasionally write about God. What do you do with newspapers? What do you do with extra Xerox sheets? Now if one is a teacher, the Shemot problem has reached epidemic proportions because you have all of this Torah stuff. In fact, it's not only the name of God. This has been extended not just to things that have the name of God on them, but things that have any psukim, any verses from the Bible. So what do people do with these mountains and mountains and mountains of paper is a very, very difficult question. Some consider recycling a permissible option as long as you don't mix the papers with garbage. In other words, if the papers are kept distinct, recycling is considered halachically permissible, huh? Yeah, in other words, if you have distinct paper recycling arrangements, that is considered to be adequate because you're not throwing it in with the general garbage, so to speak. But again, there are different questions. But all of this is traceable to this notion for the reverence that we have for God. According to some opinions, this is why Jews do not take oaths in the name of God. Now, there's a whole question whether that's valid. You know, you go to court and you're a witness. So you're asked to say, you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So help me God. Of course, I always wonder, why hasn't that been attacked on establishment of church and state grounds, to have in a court an allegiance to God, which is very strange. But you're given the option to affirm instead of swearing, and most Jews, at least who are somewhat observant, will normally take the affirmation in lieu of swearing based on the fact that there's an argument that swearing in the name of God is taking God's name in vain. The truth of the matter is, that is not really true. If one swears in the name of God to tell the truth, and they are swearing truthfully, that is not taking God's... God's name is taken in vain when you swear falsely. If you swear truthfully in God's name, Maimonides even counts it as a mitzvah, because it's giving homage to God that you're using God's name to then tell the truth. But presumably, my guess would be that since you never know whether your testimony will be totally truthful, that even if you intend to tell the truth, there may be something you forget or the like, so you don't want to take even a 1% chance that you have taken the name of God in vain. But this notion of reverence to God's name raises a lot of interesting halachic questions. For example, one of the things you can't do in halacha is you're not allowed to erase God's name. So if God's name, at least if it's in Hebrew, the English is a machloket, so you can't erase God's name or the like. How does that apply to things like erasing tapes? Let's assume you have a tape in which a bracha was recorded. Are you allowed to erase a tape or a videotape? Let's assume you have a wedding videotape that has the brachot recited under the chuppah. Right? So all of these. What does it mean erasing? What about a computer screen, which is more difficult, really? Because you could say, well, I'll keep my cassettes and I'll keep my my videotapes. But if you have a computer screen and online or through the internet, you get the text of a bracha or the like. Every time you shut up your computer, are you erasing God's name by shutting up your computer or going to another page? You got to keep it on that page the rest of your life and get another monitor for other things, right? So these would be, you know, Again, as you would imagine, in halakha we have various ways in which that's not considered mechika, that's not considered erasing. But at least the questions have to be discussed, because there's a tremendous reverence for God's name that is expressed in these commandments. And in particular, this applies to bracha levatala. Even a blessing cannot be recited in vain. If I just want to recite shahakol with God's name without drinking a glass of water, it's prohibited. In fact, they have a cute story. I think I mentioned this in my Hasidic class as well, where a chassid once asked his Rebbe, you know, what's the difference between you and I? When I want to eat, I make a bracha. And when you want to eat, you make a bracha. So what's the difference? So the Rebbe said, I'll tell you the difference. Let me describe you. You, in the middle of the day, get hungry. Got to eat something. So you look around for something to fill your hunger, and you pick up the banana. But then you know the halakha says you're not supposed to eat the banana until you make a bracha. So you make a bracha as a way of eating the banana. Says, I'm the opposite. I don't get hungry for physical food. But in the middle of the day, I get this this uncontrollable passion to praise Hashem. I have to praise Hashem. But I can't make a bracha levatala. It's a blessing in vain. So I look around. What is my excuse to make a bracha? So I pick up the banana. So the difference is, one person uses the bracha, you know, uses the bracha as an excuse to eat the banana, and the other uses the banana as an excuse to make the bracha. So that's the difference in attitude. They tell another story about bracha levatala, a blessing in vain. This is a famous story about Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, one of the great Hasidic masters, that, you know, we say, before we blow the shofar in Musaf and Rosh Hashanah, the blessing of the shofarot, so the third section of the Musaf, we talk about, blessed art you Hashem, who hears the sound of our shofar with mercy. So the Berdichever says, how do you know that? How can you make that claim? So he gave the example. Let's assume you had a child, and the child really wants to eat that some candy. But the parents told the child, no candy before dinner. So what might the child do? The child might sit down and say, Baruch Ata Hashem, say God's name, Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Shakol Li'Avid Varot. At that point, God let it to candy, otherwise it'll be a blessing in vain. So once you make a blessing, God doesn't want there to be a blessing in vain. Of course, you could give the child water or something nutritious. You know, you can find another food that might satisfy the shahakol. But the Berdichever says, when we say to God, God, you have listened to the voice of the shofar with mercy, God is stuck. He doesn't want our blessing to be a blessing in vain. So he kind of forces his hand to give us the candy. Okay, so that is the third commandment. The fourth commandment is quite extensive. See how large it is? Commandment number 3 is only verse 11. Commandment number 4 goes from verse 12 all the way to verse 15. And this is, of course, a commandment that many people don't realize are in the Ten Commandments, and that is the commandment to observe Shabbat. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, a very, very prominent retired rabbi now from Atlanta, Georgia, is now in Jerusalem. He has a story about his life in the rabbinate. It's kind of a diary of a rabbi, very entertaining stories. So he talks about a woman in his congregation went to him, and she was not very conscientious in her observance of Jewish ritual and the like. And she began, as many Jews begin, says, no, Rabbi, I'm not that religious, but I keep the Ten Commandments, and that's the main thing. You know, people say, I keep the Ten Commandments. So Rabbi Feldman looks at her and says, well, you know, the Fourth Commandment says to observe the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. So she stares at him and she says, are you sure about that? You know, so a lot of people don't know that the Fourth Commandment is indeed the commandment to observe Shabbat. But what is important here is, remember that in Beit Hanan, this is the second time the Ten Commandments are stated. This is Moshe Rabbeinu's review. The first time is in Exodus chapter 20. Now, with respect to the first three commandments, the wording in Exodus is identical to the wording in Deuteronomy. It's exactly the same. The first time we have a difference in the versions is in this fourth commandment. It is 90% the same, but there's 10% difference. And the first difference is in the very first word. That in the fourth commandment in Yitro, in Exodus chapter 20, the commandment is stated, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat. Remember the day of Shabbat to keep it holy. In this version, it does not say Zachor. As you can see, it says Shamor, observe the day of Shabbat to keep it holy. Now, it really wouldn't say, suffice to say, well, God gave the Ten Commandments twice, because this is not referring to the second commandment that Moses brought down after the sin of the golden calf. Moses is reviewing at this point the law at Sinai the first time. So the rabbinic tradition is, well, God said both at the same time. God said Zachar and Shamar in one word. In fact, that's the meaning of the Friday night song, Lechad Dodi, Shamar v'Zachar b'dibur echad. Shamar and Zachar were said together. That's the passage Friday night. What is the technical difference between Zachar and Shamar? Once again, the Talmudic interpretation that Rashi says, Rashi explains it here, is that Zachar refers to what we might call the affirmative aspects of keeping Shabbat, the recitation of Kiddush, making festive meals, dressing up nicely, glorifying Shabbat as the holy day of God. And Nachmanides adds a little twist, that remembering Shabbat even applies during the week. Because, in other words, memory connotes something that you're not presently experiencing. You remember. So you remember Shabbat even during the week. How do you remember Shabbat even during the week? Number one, Nachmanides points out that even the days of the week do not have distinct names. But we always say, this is the first day, l'Shabbat, towards Shabbat. This is the second day towards Shabbat. Every single day you think about Shabbat. And if you remember, there's a famous argument between Hillel and Shammai, that Shammai never bought anything that was not for Shabbat. If he would see a nice piece of meat, he would buy it for Shabbat, and he would not eat that piece of meat till he found a better piece of meat. So when he found a better piece of meat for Tuesday, he would buy that for Shabbat and then eat the piece of meat he bought on Monday. Every purchase was made in honor of Shabbat. So that is making Kiddush, and even making Havdalah. Making Havdalah at the end of Shabbat is a way of respecting and honoring the Shabbat by showing that we're sad that it's leaving. So that is what Zachar is. Zachar is the affirmation through positive acts of commemoration and remembrance. Shamar literally means to guard the Shabbat. Right? To be a shomer is to be a watchman. Guard the Shabbat. And that refers to the notion of erecting the fences and barriers so you do not transgress the day's sanctity. And this refers, by and large, to what we call the melachot, the various work restrictions. Of course, we have a tradition, we have 39 melachot. They're not enumerated here, of course, but you know, they're not cooking, they're not writing, they're not using fire, however you categorize electricity, but not using fire and the like. These are the melachot. So Zachar, so if one sleeps all day, one has fulfilled the shamar, because you haven't done anything wrong, but one has violated the idea of Zachar. One makes a festive meal, but one ignores the melachah restriction. One has done something. One has kept the Zachar. One has violated the shamar. So when we say shamar v'zachar come into the world simultaneously, that emphasizes that both aspects of Shabbat are equally important. Observing the melachot, observing the work restrictions, as well as commemorating Shabbat as a day of joy and a holy day. So it says Shamar and Zachar, so the way you do it is you read both. You read the Exodus and the Deuteronomy, and then you get the entire picture of what is being communicated. Now then it says, though, look at the end of verse 12. Kasher tzivcha Hashem alokecha. Keep the day, or guard the day of Shabbat as your God has commanded you. Now that little appendage does not appear in Exodus. This seems to be a rare incursion of the narrative voice of Moshe. In other words, Moshe is going over the commandments and he's kind of sticking it in. Remember, this is what God has commanded you back in Exodus. Right? So this obviously would not belong in Exodus because there God is talking. Here it is Moshe that is talking. Okay, we'll go on next week. Let me just end. I do want to end with some final thoughts about the Shabbat though, that come out of these commandments. And that is, the Shabbat liturgy is very unique. the liturgy, of course, is much later than the Torah, because Shabbat is the only liturgy for the Shemona Esrei, for the Amidah, in which you have a different middle blessing, right? The first three blessings, last three blessings are always the same, but a different middle blessing for Ma'ariv, for the evening service, for Shachrit, for the morning, and Mincha. Every other holiday, you have that common pattern, the first three blessings, the last three blessings, then the middle bracha is exactly the same. But for Shabbat, every Shabbat, you have a unique middle bracha for, again, I'm not talking about Musaf, that's always different. The Amidah, yeah, the Amidah. And that is, Friday nights, the middle bracha begins with Atah Kidashta, you sanctified the Shabbat, and it emphasizes creation. We read the paragraph of God creating the world in 6 days and resting on the seventh day. Shabbat morning, the middle bracha begins with Yismach Moshe. Moshe rejoices in the gift that he gave us, and that emphasizes the tablets that Moshe brought down from Mount Sinai, the Luchot. Shabbat Mincha, the middle blessing begins with Atah Echad. You are one, and the Jewish people are one, etc. So it's very unique that there's a different theme in those middle brachot. The commentaries explain it refers to three pivotal Shabbatot that exist in Jewish history. There is the Shabbat Bereshit, there is the Shabbat which commemorates the creation of the world, that God created the world in 6 days, rested on Shabbat, and therefore I rest on Shabbat to commemorate that. And that is the theme of Friday night, which talks about God creating the world in 6 days. Number two, there is Shabbat Matan Torah. We forget this, but the Ten Commandments were given on Shabbat. And that is the theme of Shabbat morning, which talks about Moshe bringing down the tablets of stone from Mount Sinai. That commemorates the Shabbat of Matan Torah. And the third Shabbat is interesting. It's not Saturday, but it refers to the messianic era of ultimate redemption, which is called Yom Shekulo Shabbat. You've heard that expression? A day of eternal Shabbat. And that's why we talk about unity, because the Churban, the destruction of the temple, and the Galut came because of hatred and polarization, Sinat Chinam, and therefore, towards Mincha, when our eyes look to the messianic redemption, we stress the unity between God and the Jewish people and within the Jewish people themselves. That is the theme. Now, perhaps one could take this one step further, and these three stages, Shabbat creation, Shabbat as revelation, and Shabbat as redemption, like these three stages, can also apply, again, it's very, kind of similar to Rosenzweig's analysis, that's right, can also correspond to what an individual can potentially go through every single Shabbat. The first emotion that perhaps we feel when Shabbat enters is one of relief, right? In other words, the week is kind of behind us. We're recreated. We're reborn. We're freed of all of that crushing burden. And therefore, the theme of Friday night is Shabbat as recreating the human personality. And that is Shabbat Bereshit, the Shabbat of creation. But in the morning, as Shabbat progresses, we come to a different realization. And that is, freedom is a blessing only when it is coupled with discipline and submission and commitment to the Word of God. Just like Pesach is always linked to Shavuot, Pesach is freedom, Shavuot is submission to the Torah. The two are connected by the counting of the Omer. Because freedom without responsibility is decadence. Freedom enables responsibility. And therefore, Shabbat morning, we reach the perception of submission to Matan Torah. Then finally, when we integrate those two ideas, emotional liberation and commitment to the will of God, we are ready for the unity within ourselves that can allow there to be a redemption. And therefore, the truth is, you're really ready for Shabbat only when Shabbat is over. Because the Shabbat, as it were, prepares you spiritually for the redemption of closeness to God and unity with each other. And then it's all over, right? So that might be why the Talmud says
if the Jews were to keep two Shabbatot, they would be redeemed. Because you need a Shabbat to be ready for a Shabbat. You can't just do it cold. This explains another grammatical anomaly, that Shabbat is referred to in three different genders, male, female, and plural. Friday night, in the bracha that says, we talk about Yanuchu Va, may the Jewish people rest in her. Shabbat morning, Yanuchu Bo, may the Jewish people rest in him. Shabbat Mincha, Yanuchu Vam, may the Jewish people rest in them. Shabbat female, feminine, masculine, plural. Perhaps it reflects these transitions. When Shabbat is perceived as recreation and rebirth, the feminine imagery is appropriate because we look at Shabbat as our mother, the mother that gives us life again. The week has deadened us, the week has killed us, the week has sapped our energies. And now we are reborn. The Shabbat facilitates our recreation, and thus it is feminine. In the morning, which emphasizes Matan Torah, submission to the will of God, we look at God as the disciplinarian, as it were. And again, the male image is at least traditionally associated. Many families, that's obviously not the case, but traditionally we look at the male as the teacher of the Torah and the one who lays down the rules, so to speak. So Shabbat is referred to in the masculine, because it's no longer a birthing image, it's a pedagogical image. Shabbat Mincha, we talk about integration, taking the different extremities of emotional and intellect and bringing them together. So we refer to the plural because that takes the many and makes them one, which paves the way for redemption. So even those subtle differences in the tefillot can indicate the spiritual transformations that a Shabbat can affect.
And as you mentioned number three, emotion and intellect, I've been thinking of Hamas Allah.
Mm-hmm.
Is Shabbat there in the plural? Or
You know, it's interesting. The word Shabbat does not appear in Havilah. The only reference to Shabbat is Yom HaShavi'i. God separated between the seventh day and the rest. So the word Shabbat is not referred to at all, but it's an interesting point. Because that's just a thought about Shabbat that we can think about, that how much potential there exists in every Shabbat for that type of spiritual redemption that a human being can attain. And as somebody once said, the issue about Shabbat should not be, you know, I don't keep Shabbat or I keep Shabbat. It shouldn't be one of sin. It should be one of missed opportunity. Meaning, not keeping Shabbat is not so much a matter of Aveira, although it is, but it's a matter of missing the opportunity that Shabbat can provide for our lives. And in fact, by the way, I should say, the very word in Hebrew for sin exactly means that. The word chetz, which we always translate as sin, means missing a target. If you shoot an arrow, lahachtia tamatara means to miss a target. Sin is not, you know, evil, bad, you know, guilt. Sin is one misses the opportunities for meaning that God puts in our lives. It's a very interesting way of looking at what a sin is. Okay, we'll continue with it. Next week we're on, right?
No, next week
we're not. Okay. Okay. Okay, so we'll see you the 18th and we will continue.
Excellent. Very good issue.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you coming.
Oh, I love it. But I can't tell, I'm mad.
It's very hard to find. I think it was even 5 times out of your Rabbi Frank, are you thinking you can give us your program or some of the other things you do with this community?
Sure.
Okay,
maybe I'll write it down and pass it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other hand, it's going to be a long commute for those of us for the next year.
We'll have to do a video conferencing.
When are you planning to travel?
Maybe not 100% set, but I think we're talking about July or August.
I'm actually going to be by August. I'm hoping to attend the Shalom Hartman Institute, although I haven't seen that.
Oh, for how long? For the year?
Not for a whole year. Just for nice. Just for the, they have a short seminar that they offer, so I understand. A friend of mine went to it last year. In fact, I thought I might ask you, I don't have a great background in text study in the traditional sense, and a lot of the people there will. My friend who was there said, don't worry about it, you'll be okay. My feeling is it would be nice if I could do something about that.
Well, you know, if you could give yourself more time in Israel, there are institutions that can help you. It's harder here.
Anyway, I just happened to be reading for the other reasons. Mostly about issues having to do with, there's a big piece on determinism and free will. He's speaking here now not so much, Berlin had a philosophical background, but here he's speaking more as an intellectual historian, and it's kind of on the border between philosophical concepts of free will and determinism, and also the ordinary uses of history.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying it. These came out, immediately
post-war.
He's
a wonderful writer. The Two Concepts of Liberty is also very famous, positive liberty, negative liberty.
Yeah, is that in here? Some of the other things that came out recently, I've enjoyed very much. One thing that I think of interest to people, Jewish people, could be Against the Current, where he talks about, for instance, even the Enlightenment, there were thinkers who moved against the way things. Just some interesting stuff. Probably. Sort of relaxed reading of whatever you feel like putting off the shelf is somewhat limited for you.
Yeah, that's true. He's a wonderful writer. You know, a very funny story. You know, Churchill, Berlin used to send dispatches. Did you read about Irving Berlin?
Another one, yes. that was in one of the biographies.
A nice guy, but he writes so much better than he talks.
That's how that ended.
That was the line, Churchill. just writes so much better.
Another I Berlin.
Yeah.
I was doing a little informal mini lecture on Jewish music. You know, what is it? And somebody said, "Well, you know, Jewish music is by a Jewish composer." So I started singing "White Christmas."
Right.
I'm not sure that's an easy way to start.
Or "Come All Ye Faithful" by Felix Mendelssohn.
I'm sure he said a name, and I didn't catch it.
Well, he already converted.
Two generations away. His parents converted.
Right. Okay.
I wish we could claim him.
Right.
Rabbi, when you were talking about Menashe, whose father was in
Hezekiah, which is Hezekiahu. That is not the same as...
Not as Hezekiah.
No, Hezekiah, yeah. That's how you pronounce the one. Yeah.
I don't know how to pronounce
Hezekiah.
It. Oh, then that's
in Hebrew, it's Hezekiahu.
Hezekiahu.
With the chet, yeah.
Well, now, after you talked about that, and you talked about running through the thorns, and how powerful this Yehudah was... Was there a person, a prophet, or somebody you quoted that I might have missed when you were saying how strong this power of the Yetzer Hara was?
Well,
or was that Menashe himself?
So Menashe told them that. Gave them that story and said, you know, don't think you're better than me. Had you lived in my house, you would have come.
And there weren't particular rabbis that you talked
I didn't mention
you
their names. Right? Yeah, just rabbis. Yeah.
That's fine. That was a great story. I've missed coming here, and I want you to know that I have been very honored to be with you for the last few years.
My privilege.
All kinds of wonderful luck coming here.
Thank you.
And
with
having you back. I have to be here in 2 weeks, but I'm studying for my comps, and I'm sort of going crazy. But there's good news, and that is that I passed my Hebrew exam.
Fantastic. That's really what your big word.
It was an incredible experience. 3.5 years. Every time I go to the Siddur on Shabbat, and I'm a Shabbat goer, I was worried about Hebrew exam. And the last two Shabbatot, I enjoyed them immensely because I didn't have to worry about it. It was stupid exam, and I could just pray.
You can just pray. Right.
I thought you'd appreciate my story here.
I was just saying, everything that you said today, it's like so great. What are we going to do next year without you?
We'll have to do video conferencing. Talk about the BJ investing a little money.
I mean, you have no idea how I look forward to this, and I come up with this and discuss this for days. I'm real.
Okay, that's great.
Come to the rabbi's class on Sunday mornings. Question about Menashe. If there was a prophecy that he was going to be a Rasha, where is Brei Rasha?
I think we have to understand that the only thing Chizkiyahu could have had an intimation of was tendencies within the personality. Not that it was a foregone conclusion, but he would have a tendency towards bad, which would require extra channeling and extra discipline, which could have been provided. You see, and maybe that's why it's so self-destructive to have a view of your kid as having those tendencies, because that sometimes gives you the inclination not to do what needs to be done.
Right.
When in fact, a kid like that needs more attention.
More attention. And this is what happens in classrooms when the teacher looks upon a certain kid as being dumb. That attitude, self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. So sometimes it's better not to know, not to label and not to know.
I gave Rabbi Breidowitz